This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian. Here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. It's the podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of February 23rd, 2026. High in the mountains of Arizona, the peaks and forests are quietly building up the state's water supply. The snow that falls at high elevations will melt off and fill reservoirs around the valley. Alex Hager tagged along with a team of scientists on a mission to better understand the snow and what it means for the people downstream.
When these researchers want to find snow, they've got to look deep in the woods. This team of scientists with the Salt River Project is trudging through a fresh blanket of white in the Coconino National Forest, more than 7,000 feet above sea level. Zachary Keller is one of them.
I can't believe they pay me to do this. Best job I ever had.
It's a bright, sunny day, and the snow underfoot is a little slushy. It's starting to get heavy and wet. And the snow that melts here, today and into the spring, doesn't stay here. It flows far away.
Most of the water that everybody uses down the valley, our 2.5 million customers, the vast majority of that is generated during spring runoff, snow melt. And so understanding how much water is up here in the snow before it starts to melt is really crucial to us.
A snowflake here melts into a few small creeks, then the Verde River. From there, the agency collects it in a series of reservoirs in the hills outside Phoenix until it's needed in the taps and irrigation canals below.
Did you notice all the running water off the side of the interstate or the highways are coming up? Making its way down the hill. We saw that on our way up. We were pretty excited to see that.
But before it gets there, Keller and his colleagues can take measurements here to figure out how much water will be in those reservoirs.
We're going to head over here. I'm going to take this tube. I'll put it in the ground at our predetermined location. Give a little twist here. And then I'll pull it back out. Let's go measure.
You ready to measure?
I am ready. All right, this one was a good one. 9 on the dot.
These old-school measurements link together with high-tech snow data and give SRP's water planners a forecast. The data this year, it's okay. The Verde River system is below average for this time of year, but SRP's Stephen Flora says it was a rainy fall that loaded up the dirt with moisture, so any new water won't get soaked up.
This snowpack here, since the soil's already saturated, we're going to expect that to run off. So if we don't get any more storms, our forecasts can go down. If we get a good March and we get some more storms, it can go quite a bit up.
Flora says climate change makes this water supply highly variable and harder to predict. This time of year last year, there was half as much snow. But in 2023, there was 5 times as much.
We might have longer stretches of drought. We might have more severe drought. But we're also going to have wetter years, bigger floods and bigger winters and seasons that can have a lot of flow across the Salt and Verde watershed.
What happens over the course of the next few weeks, the snowstorms that do or don't arrive, the temperature that could cause snow to melt quickly or last later into the season, that'll have ripple effects for months. Erin Ann Saffel is the Arizona State climatologist.
We're all very excited when we get a wet summer, when we get a lot of the thunderstorm activity. But really, those wet summers aren't necessarily part of our water supply.
That's because winter snow, just like the kind we're measuring today, makes up a huge chunk of the water in the state's reservoirs. More than 60% of SRP's water supply arrives in the winter. And right now, the agency's reservoirs are a little more than half full. Again, Zachary Keller.
We have the storage capacity to capture that. Other states don't. It runs right down and out because they don't have a big enough reservoir to capture that and store it for when they actually need it. So reservoirs can be a very good thing in terms of drought resiliency, and we are very equipped in that department.
These snow forecasts will help inform how SRP works those reservoirs in the summer, how much they can let flow downstream, and how much they'll need to rely on other resources like groundwater for their customers. But for now, Keller and his team will keep tracking the snow and waiting for the big melt. Alex Hager, KJZZ News, Coconino County.
In tribal natural resources, Back in May, the Interior Department fast-tracked review of a proposed uranium mine in record time. A process that typically takes years was completed in just 11 days. It's part of President Trump's agenda to expedite permitting for energy projects on public lands. As Gabriel Pietrazio reports, tribes and environmentalists say this decision is rushed and merely a rubber stamp.
On my way to Utah's Lisbon Valley, home to the proposed Velvetwood uranium mine, I had to ditch my SUV on dirt roads near the border of Colorado.
I'm really close. There was no way I was gonna get up this on a rental. This area right here, southeastern Utah, is becoming the hub for this uranium renaissance.
And Canada's Anfield Energy wants to tap into that opportunity. But first, the federal government must consult with tribes. The Bureau of Land Management contacted 30 of them, including Arizona's Navajo Nation and Hopi Tribe. Only three of them commented. And letters obtained by KJZZ detail how deeply disappointed tribes are, writing, "How could there be any meaningful consultation between them and the U.S. if they're only given 7 days to respond?"
Drill, baby, drill.
President Trump declared a national energy emergency on his first day in office.
"We will bring prices down, fill our strategic reserves up again, right to the top, and export American energy all over the world."
While Anfield CEO Corey Diaz did not respond to interview requests from KJZZ, he made a pitch to investors back in May, just days before news broke of the BLM's fast-tracked process.
"This is one of the core assets that we have within our portfolio. There's historic production at the site of 4 million pounds of uranium, 5 million pounds of vanadium. We can work with the state of Utah to get the license upgraded from its standby status to operational."
While the feds approved the project in record time, Anfield still needs permits from Utah. For Sarah Fields with Moab-based nonprofit Uranium Watch, she says Anfield is leveraging the situation
to put out news releases and talk about this, and things are going ahead. Great, great, great. So please invest in us.
Part of Anfield's plan is to reopen its old facility, Shooter Ring Canyon, one of only three licensed uranium mills nationwide. It's been dormant since 1982. Keeping tabs on this proposal has been a tall order for attorney Aaron Paul with the nonprofit Grand Canyon Trust.
"The mine plan was over 700 pages long. It's difficult for anybody to review quickly."
He read through all of it and replied to the BLM.
"There's no good reason to rush this permit, and it's essentially a way to sidestep environmental review, truncate it, and shorten it so much that it can't be meaningful."
Zuni Tribal Historic Preservation Officer Kurt Donguski didn't even realize the BLM reached out. Tribes are inundated with requests to review proposals like the Velvetwood uranium mine that could impact cultural and natural resources.
"And depending on the agency, I have to make a decision on whether it's worth the time and effort to respond. Because oftentimes I will with comments and I never hear back from them."
On average, a company waits about 4 years for a federal permit to be issued. University of Arizona law professor Justin Pideau believes Trump has gone too far.
"At a speed that is breathtakingly fast, part of this flood the zone approach, it's clear that they don't want to do it right."
Pideau also served on President Biden's Council on Environmental Quality. He says this streamlining is making a mockery of the Nixon-era National Environmental Protection Act.
"It's an insult. It's designed for failure. The idea that you could give a tribe 7 days and feel like you are doing anything that is honoring a trust responsibility the United States has to tribes is laughable."
For KJZZ News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio reporting from Lisbon Valley, Utah.
In business news, Thursday was 1 month since federal authorities raided more than a dozen sports bars and restaurants in Metro Phoenix. The investigation led by a division of Immigration and Customs Enforcement has continued, but there have been no more arrests. Matthew Casey reports.
Federal agents arrested nearly 40 people on suspicion of being in the country illegally, but only four employees are accused of crimes. The owner of Zips Sports Grills has not been charged. Muzaffer Chishti, with the Nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., says employers rarely go to jail in connection with worksite raids.
That in almost all cases of employment enforcement, the price is paid by the workers, and the employees typically get away with a slap on the wrist.
Chishti says to commit a crime, employers have to knowingly hire undocumented people. And the system they use to check if employment documents are valid does not also check if the identity matches the person using them. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening.
Rio Salado College is hosting the Dash with Rio 5K and 10K Run Walk in Tempe on Saturday, April 18th. This community event welcomes runners and walkers of all levels with early bird registration for a limited time. Details at dashwithrio.com.
In education news. The Tucson Unified School District has approved about $2.6 million of what is expected to be a total of about $10 million in cuts from its budget for next year. From the Education Desk, Bridget Dowd reports.
The district is projected to have a $27 million budget deficit by 2030 and has been identified as a high financial risk district by the Arizona Auditor General. At a governing board meeting this week, Superintendent Gabriel Trujillo highlighted several factors that have led to declines in enrollment and therefore less money coming into the district.
The rise of vouchers that have now siphoned off over $30 million that would have been available to TUSD. Folks waiting longer to have kids. Folks not having kids. And to me, the most disturbing stat is 47% of homeowners east of Swan being 55 or over.
The first cut will eliminate some traveling substitute teaching and administrative positions. The board has also directed the budget committee to explore possible school consolidations for the following academic year. Bridget Dowd, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In science news. Crews with the Salt River Project are dumping thousands of fish into Phoenix area canals in an effort to keep them clean. As Alex Hager reports, the fish eat plants that might otherwise clog up water pipes.
That's the sound of a truckload of carp splashing into a canal in Tempe. They'll join more than 40,000 other fish in the canal system. SRP scientist Brian Moorhead says removing all those aquatic plants would be a lot harder with human crews.
It's a long day of pulling a lot of very heavy vegetation out of the canal. Very labor-intensive and expensive. So the fish come in, they eat 24/7.
These carp aren't native to the U.S., so SRP only brings in fish that can't reproduce. The agency spent about $250,000 on this year's fish. Alex Hager, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In Fronteras News, businesses in Puerto Peñasco or Rocky Point are urging visitors not to change their spring break plans after cartel violence in other parts of Mexico. From the Fronteras desk in Hermosillo, Nina Kravinsky has more.
After the killing of Mexico's most wanted cartel leader by the Mexican military Sunday, retaliatory violence spread through many parts of the country. But about 1,000 miles away from the epicenter of that violence, it's business as usual in Puerto Peñasco, except that some Arizona visitors are canceling their spring break plans. Local business owners like Will Dunn, who charters trips on his two-bedroom yacht, are working on calming tourist fears ahead of the busy spring break season.
You know, if there was a riot broke out in Florida, would us people in Arizona be concerned?
Dunn has had one cancellation for safety concerns. Keith Allen with Encanto May Resorts says their company has had around 80 cancellations since violence broke out in the state of Jalisco on Sunday.
Hopefully people will come to their senses and realize the distance again and the fact that it's extremely safe here.
There have been no reports of violence or blocked travel on the stretch of highway between the Lukeville border crossing into Mexico and Puerto Peñasco. Nina Kravinsky, KJZZ News, Hermosillo.
And finally, from KJZZ's original production, The Show. Research has shown that the impact that created Meteor Crater in northern Arizona may have dammed the Colorado River. Here's co-host Mark Brody.
More than 50,000 years ago, a meteor hit Earth and formed what we now call Meteor Crater in northern Arizona. But new research finds that impact may have had, well, impacts beyond that one site. A paper hypothesizes that event may have also triggered landslides in the Grand Canyon, more than 100 miles away. Those landslides may have led to a damming of the Colorado River, creating a lake. The evidence for this, at least in part, comes from driftwood from Stanton's Cave along the river inside the canyon. Chris Basin is a research specialist at the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research at the University of Arizona and has worked on this research. He joins me to talk more about it. And Chris, how surprising is what you found in the sense that one event triggered other events?
Well, I think it's pretty unusual to, you know, it wasn't what we were looking for. This was not a research question when the initial investigation started. It was just an attempt to verify the dating on some wood that we had in our archive, as it might have been related to something that work that Jonathan Palmer was doing down in New Zealand.
So you were just trying to figure out, like, how old this wood was, and it kind of led you to this other discovery?
Yeah, so Jonathan and some people down under there were investigating this magnetic pole reversal that occurred around 42, 43,000 years ago with tree rings and radiocarbon work. And the wood that this driftwood we had from Stanton's Cave had been previously dated to around 43,000 years. So we wanted to verify if it really was 43,000 years ago and therefore might bear on the research that Jonathan and his colleagues were already doing. When we got the date back, it turned out to be over 50,000 years old. So, you know, it didn't have anything to do with that period of time that we had initially been interested in. And Jonathan had, previous to a visit to Tucson, had stopped at the Meteor Crater and was aware of the proposed date for the impact there. And so when we got the date for the wood, he just kind of in an off-the-cuff way, the way that you might, if you're having a conversation at a bar or something, oh, isn't that interesting, you know, that the meteor struck about the same time as the date, the radiocarbon date we got for the wood. And the group of people that were involved with that radiocarbon dating and myself, you know, we just kind of kicked it around a little bit and said, well, that is kind of interesting. Maybe there's something there. Maybe we should look into it.
Well, so how did you go about trying to connect one to the other?
So the first was to investigate what the researchers who had looked at the driftwood in Stanton's Cave back in the 1970s and early 80s, see what they had said and what their reasoning was for why there was driftwood in this cave that's really high above the river. And, you know, their hypothesis was that downstream from the cave, a section of the canyon wall had collapsed and dammed the river and made a lake. And this had raised the water level near the cave high enough to allow in flood times for driftwood to be deposited in on the cave floor. So the fact that there was this rockfall, which is unusual. I mean, there are not many events like that that have occurred in the canyon that people are aware of. This rockfall is an unusual event. The meteor impact is an unusual event. And we began to speculate that they might be linked.
What is the significance of the fact that this one event triggered more impacts? I guess maybe impacts is not the right word, but more incidents on Earth?
Well, meteor strikes, of course, are a common occurrence in our solar system, but on Earth, there are not that many large ones that are recent. So a meteor crater is an example of one that's, in geologic terms, relatively recent. The crater's well-preserved, and it's possible to actually study it a little bit. So, you know, it's a nice opportunity to maybe try to see if, you know, we can demonstrate that these things are actually connected and that the rockfall might well have been a consequence of the impact.
Is it possible that there are more consequences, like more events happened as a result of the sort of the chain reaction here?
Well, I mean, there's been some work done estimating what the impact did in the local area. Of course, it spread debris all over the place, a kind of a rain of fiery debris, and probably caused wildfires. There's a sediment core in a lake that's not too distant from the crater, where there's a charcoal layer that might be associated with some fires that were caused by the impact, and certainly the wildlife and, you know, things that were around the crater were highly impacted. But this is at some distance, it's over 100 miles away, so that's yeah. kind of interesting, and it serves as just a reminder of you know, you have an event, you can see the crater, but then trying to understand what would happen, you know, if we were to observe such a thing today. That's an important line of investigation, I think.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought up the distance because, as you say, you know, the Grand Canyon is not right next door to Meteor Crater here. It's as you referenced, about 100 miles away. Is there a significance to the fact that the impact at Meteor Crater could have an impact that far away? Like, does that tell us anything maybe about the size of the impact or about the dynamics of the impact in some way, that it could affect events so far away from where it actually happened?
We're hoping that some follow-on work will try to model the seismic effect of the impact and look at the structural geology of the terrain between the crater and the canyon to see how effective that those rock layers might be to transmit the impact, and maybe provide a little more evidence that would support the hypothesis that we put forward.
So does that mean that it would be dependent on sort of what's below the surface to determine, it would help you figure out, like, why something that
sure.
happened at
I mean,
Meteor Crater affected the Grand Canyon?
So the impact caused an earthquake, you know, what we would refer to as an earthquake. But as opposed to the typical seismic activity that we have when we think of, you know, the San Andreas Fault or something, those occur well below the surface, sometimes many kilometers below the surface. And this is a seismic shock that was delivered to the surface layers. So the upper layers would be the ones that would transmit this laterally over to the canyon. And that's the Colorado Plateau. There's sedimentary layers that stretch all across there. So it would be helpful to have a model that was specific to that region, and then a simulation of what we think the explosive force was and how that might be transmitted.
All right. That is Chris Basin, a tree ring scientist at the University of Arizona. Chris, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks, Mark.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Katina Foundation and Basis Charter Schools, Palo Verde Generating Station, SRP, and the Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust. Thank you for listening and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian. This is KJZZ. Listen more, learn more, online and on the KJZZ mobile app.